Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 49, Patrick here, CJ Evolution. Thank you for tuning in. Whatever you are doing, wherever you are at, I hope you are well. Tonight I wanted to talk a little bit about critical issues in policing. And I wanted to talk about the guiding principles on use of force. This is brought to you by the Police Executive Research Forum, and I will have this linked up at the end of this podcast. But I wanted to go over the 30 guiding principles, and a lot of this is tailored, again, to use of force issues. And I don't think there's a day that goes by, maybe there is in some departments, but most departments on a daily basis are going to deal with some sort of use of force issues. Remember, at least where you're at least depends on where you're at, but in my department, you know, we all have use of force matrices or continuums, and it all starts with officer presence, believe it or not. That could be considered a use of force. But I wanted to talk about the 30 guiding principles. Very interesting. I've never read these before until about a week ago, and I wanted to get on here and talk about it because I think it's so important. Now, the guiding principles are particularly relevant to situations that involve subjects who are unarmed or are armed with weapons other than firearms. And the principles that we're going to talk about are also relevant to police encounters with people who have mental illnesses, and we all know that those are going up, at least where I'm at, a developmental disability, a mental condition such as autism or drug addiction, or any other condition that can cause them to behave erratically and potentially dangerously. There's always going to be situations where police officers will need to use force, including deadly force, to protect them or themselves. Nothing in these guiding principles should be interpreted as suggesting that police officers should hesitate to use force that is necessary to mitigate a threat to the safety of themselves or others. So policy number one, the sanctity of human life should be at the heart of everything an agency does. Whether it's mission statements, policies, and training curricula should emphasize the sanctity of human life. The general public, police officers, and criminal suspects, and the importance of treating all people with dignity and respect. Number two, agencies should continue to develop best policies, practices, and training on use of force issues that go beyond the minimum requirements of Graham versus Connor. I think we all remember that landmark Supreme Court case in 1989. Graham v. Connor holds that police use of force is to be judged against the standard of objective reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment ban on unreasonable searches and seizures. Specifically, the court said this: the reasonableness of a particular use of force must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene, rather than the 20/20 vision of hindsight. The calculus of reasonableness must embody allowance for the fact that police officers are often forced to make split-second judgments. A lot of people don't even realize that. They just get what they know of police officers off TV and the movies. We know that. So split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving. About the amount of force that is necessary in a particular situation. So I know we've all heard Graham v. Connor, but it's very, very important. So that was number two. Number three, police use of force must meet the test of proportionality. In assessing whether a response is proportional to the threat being faced, officers should consider the following. Am I using only the level of force necessary to mitigate the threat and safety to achieve a lawful objective? Is there another less injurious option available that will allow me to achieve the same objective as effectively and safely? And will my actions be viewed as appropriate by my agency and by the general public, given the severity of the threat and the totality of the circumstances? That I use that term all the time when I'm teaching, and I know we've all heard it before, but the totality, everything taken together, the totality of the circumstances, bring everything together. So policy number four, adopt de-escalation as formal agency policy. Now there's times where we can't de-escalate. It is rapidly evolving, but the majority of times, in my experience, not that I have all the experience, and I'm sure many, many other officers out there have more experience than me, but the majority of time we have time on our side where we can talk our way out of things. So number five, the critical decision-making model provides a new way to approach critical incidents. So critical decision-making model, again, a way we can look towards solution. The CDM guides officers through a process of collecting information, assessing the situation, threats, and risk, considering police powers and agency policy, identifying options, and determining the best course of action, and acting, reviewing, and reassessing the situation. So number six, duty to intervene. Officers need to prevent other officers from using excessive force. Maybe you've had a time where you've been out with partners, or you get into a situation, or you're talking with somebody, and it escalates, and one, maybe a couple officers are escalating, and they are using excessive force. You have a duty to intervene as officers. I know there's the code of silence and all that stuff out there, folks, but it's just not worth putting your career on the line. So officers should be obligated to intervene when they believe another officer is about to use excessive or unnecessary force, or when they witness colleagues using excessive and unnecessary force or engaging in other misconduct. So very, very important. You know, those Serpico days are over. If you've ever seen the movie Serpico about rampant corruption within the NYPD back in the 70s, that's what created the Knapp Commission. But we have to intervene, folks. Policy number seven, respect the sanctity of life by promptly rendering first aid. We saw that African-American subject that ran away from the police, South Carolina. I believe the trial is going on right now. This happened about a year ago where the officer shot this person in the back several times. And one of the criticisms not only was shooting this person in the back, but not rendering first aid after the shooting. Officers should render first aid to subjects who have been injured as a result of police actions and should promptly request medical assistance when you can. So number eight, shooting at vehicles must be prohibited. Again, each agency is going to come up with their own policies, but agencies should adopt a prohibition against shooting at or from a moving vehicle unless someone in the vehicle is using or threatening deadly force by means other than the vehicle itself. So again, policy and certain departments are going to dictate this stuff. I think personally, if somebody is trying to run you over with a car, you should be able to probably use deadly force because that car is considered a deadly weapon. So number nine, prohibit use of deadly force against individuals who possess a danger only to themselves. So agencies should prohibit the use of deadly force and carefully consider the use of many less lethal options against individuals who pose a danger only to themselves and not to other members of the public or to officers. Number 10, document use of force incidents and review data and enforcement practices to ensure that they are fair and non-discriminatory. So we, in my department, and I don't think there's a department out there, maybe there are, but you have to document, for obvious reasons, use of force incidents and review that data, make sure that they are fair and non-discriminatory. So that was number 10. Number 11, to build understanding and trust, agencies should issue regular reports to the public on use of force. Again, departments are different. Some might issue that and some may not. Number 12, all critical police incidents resulting in death or serious bodily injury should be reviewed by specially trained personnel. So that's number 12. Number 13, or policy number 13, agencies need to be transparent in providing information following use of force incidents. The last thing an agency needs to do is start covering things up. We need to be transparent. It might be embarrassing. It might be a flaw in the policy, a violation of policy, or it might be criminal. But sooner or later, we have to be transparent about that information. Policy 14, training academy content and culture must reflect agency values. We need to be able to not only walk the walk, but talk the talk. Policy 15, officers should be trained to use critical decision making models. Very, very important. Number 16, use distance, cover, and time to replace outdated concepts such as the 21-foot rule and drawing a line in the sand. Agencies should train their officers on the principles of using distance, cover, and time when approaching and managing critical incidents. In many situations, a better outcome can result if officers can buy more time to assess the situation and their options, bring in additional resources to the scene, and develop a plan for resolving the incident without use of force or only with the force that is necessary to mitigate the threat. Agencies should eliminate from their policies and training all references to the so-called 21-foot rule regarding officers who are confronted with a subject armed with an edged weapon. Instead, officers should be trained to use distance and cover to create a reaction gap or safe zone between themselves and the individual, and to consider all options for responding. Number 17, or policy 17, de-escalation should be a core theme of an agency's training program. So agencies should train their officers on a comprehensive program of de-escalation strategies and tactics designed to diffuse tense encounters. We've all been on the scene with that one officer who is kind of escalating when we're all trying to de-escalate. De-escalation can be used in a range of situations, especially when confronting subjects who are combative and or suffering a crisis because of mental illness, substance abuse, developmental disabilities, or any other conditions that can cause them to behave erratically and dangerously. So very important. Number 18, de-escalation starts with effective communications. Folks, not everything we do starts with communication. Not only communication, but effective communication. To effectively carry out an agency's de-escalation strategies, all officers should receive rigorous and ongoing training on communication skills. Not only communication, but effective communication. Number 19, mental illness. Implement a comprehensive agency training program on dealing with people with mental health issues. A lot of our officers go through CIT training, crisis intervention training, as well as other training out there. So officers must be trained in how to recognize people with mental health issues and deal with them in a safe and humane manner. Many agencies already provide some sort of crisis intervention training as a key element of de-escalation, but crisis intervention policies and training must be merged with a new focus on tactics that officers can use to de-escalate situation. Very, very important. CIT training is awesome. For those of you who haven't gone through it, you need to go through it. Number 20, tactical training and mental health training need to be interwoven to improve response to critical incidents. Very, very important. Number 21, community-based outreach teams can be a valuable component to agencies' mental health response. I know we work well with a lot of different agencies out there. I'm sure most departments do. Number 22, provide a prompt supervisory response to critical incidents to reduce the likelihood of unnecessary force. I'm sure in many critical incidents, command staff is going to be on scene, and they should be to manage that scene along with the officers on scene. Number 23, training as teams can improve performance in the field. A lot of agencies out there have team concepts when it comes to scheduling, and I know a lot of officers, they work in teams, and that is so important. Scenario-based training should be prevalent, challenging, and realistic. CIT training is good with that. Very, very realistic. They bring in actors that kind of go through these scenarios for the officers. And that was number 24. So number 25, officers need access to and training in less lethal options. Many departments out there have less lethal options. That includes taser, beanbags, foam rounds, all kinds of less lethal options out there. OC, oleoresin capsicone, is another option that each agency is going to be different in their arsenals of less lethal. Number 26, agencies should consider new options for chemical spray. So interesting. So number 27, an ECW deployment that is not effective does not mean that the officer should automatically move to their firearms. So we're talking about an electronic control weapons, i.e. taser. So accounts of fatal police shootings often state that the officer tried the ECW and it had no effect, so the officer then had to use a firearm. According to PERF, this is an appropriate way to view force options. ECWs often do not work because the subject is wearing heavy clothing and for many other reasons. An ECW deployment that is not effective does not mean officers should automatically move to their firearms. But again, I think it's going to depend on the situation, right? Number 28, personal protection shields enhance officer safety and may support de-escalation efforts during critical incidents, including situations involving police with persons with knives, baseball bats, or other improvised weapons that are not firearms. Number 29, well-trained call takers and dispatchers are essential to the police response to critical incidents. Get to know your dispatcher, folks, if you haven't already. We're all on the same team, you know, and they, you know, it's so important to have a good relationship with your dispatcher. A number of controversial uses of force by police have stemmed from failures of call takers and dispatchers to obtain or relay to responding officers critically important information about the nature of the incident. So very, very important to have those relationships again with your call centers, with your dispatchers. So last and not least, but number 30, or policy number 30, educate the families of persons with mental illness on communicating with the call takers. Agencies should work with their local mental health care provider community and organizations such as the National Alliance on Mental Illness to create outreach and educational programs for the families of persons with mental illness. Specifically, agencies should instruct family members on the types of information and details they should provide when calling 911 for an incident involving their loved one. This type of outreach can minimize any stigma family members may feel and increase their confidence in the police response. It will also help ensure that call takers, dispatch, and responding officers have a more complete picture of any mental health issue associated with the call for service. So, folks, that is it. And that is through the PERF, that is from the PERF report. And I will be posting that or linked up to this podcast. So I hope it was beneficial to everybody. I know it was beneficial, very beneficial to me when I read that report from a couple years back. But I hope everybody is doing well. And I hope you have a great start to your week, Monday, starting tomorrow. And like I said, folks, we've got a lot of exciting things coming with CJ Evolution. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and sign off for the evening and take care, everybody. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.